This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
You've got the magic touch.
Ooh.
It makes me glow so much.
Ooh.
It casts a spell. It rings a bell.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I recently watched a wonderful documentary called An Honest Liar, which was about James the Amazing Randi. Included in this great story is a little subtext, which was about the Alpha Project, which Steve Shaw, a.k.a. Banachek, and Mike Edwards were involved with back in the late 70s, early 80s for about a three-year period. After the show was over towards the end, they were kind of giving an update on what everyone is doing today, and one of the things they mentioned was that Mike Edwards lives in Phoenix. Well, it so happened I was going to be traveling to Phoenix, so I thought, well, I'll just give him a call and find out if we can get together. Now, I had not met Mike before, but I called Banachek, and he said Mike would be glad to talk about the Alpha Project, just give him a call, and so based upon his recommendation, I did, and it couldn't have gone over better. Fantastic guy, great fun, full of a lot of energy, and gave me a lot of insight. Now, I've been aware of the Alpha Project, as many of you have in the past, by hearing what Banachek has told us and also what's been in the newspapers or reported elsewhere. And so people get little drips and drabs of this Alpha Project, which is kind of legendary. So I would say that now you're going to get a little bit more in-depth from another perspective, that is from Mike Edwards' perspective, talking about how he got involved with the Alpha Project, also with James Randi, and what he's doing today. And it kind of comes full circle, and it really is kind of, to me, a surprise at the end. So stay tuned, and I hope you enjoy this episode with Mike Edwards here on The Magic Word.
Yep, touch.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Today we have something very special and very different, and I've come all the way out to Phoenix, Arizona for the exclusive reason of getting to speak with my new friend, Mike Edwards. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Scott. It's a pleasure to be here.
So do you really go by Mike or Michael? What would you prefer?
It depends. If I'm in trouble, then my mother would always call me Michael, and you know you're in real trouble when they use the middle name.
I was going to say the middle name.
We'll go by Mike. That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, whenever that recently I had was watching the James Randi's documentary on The Honest Liar, and towards the end that it was saying that you lived in Phoenix, and of course being involved with the Alpha Project, those people who are just listening to this to know my primary reason what we're going to be talking about, and then was saying that you're living in Phoenix, so I called Banachek, and he said, oh yeah, Mike's number is over here, but then he said, then whenever I told you, that whenever I first called you, you said, I don't want to trust Banachek. And I told Banachek, he laughed, so don't trust everything Mike tells you either. So.
Well, now that we have the level table set.
That's right. Don't trust anybody. Which was what that whole thing was about.
That's,
I think,
exactly,
you know, from
right.
Being an honest liar, you didn't want to trust anybody, although they trusted you for the whole thing.
Unfortunately, I think, much to their dismay, they did. The scientists and the parapsychologists did trust us.
There's so much I really want to talk about. You know, Banachek, being my best friend, we've been business partners since 87. I've talked with him, and he's, you know, shared the microphone with me lots of times here on the Magic Word, but we really haven't had a chance to talk then with you. So when he was saying to give you a call, that and I did, I was actually going to be coming out just for a family thing to see the family here in Phoenix, I thought, well, this is going to work out great. And so at the end of the movie, though, that you of An Honest Liar was saying that you lived here in Phoenix, but I guess you were saying that an earlier version said you were in Colorado, and they edited it.
Well, I just moved to Phoenix about a year ago from Denver, where I spent 26 years.
Okay.
So I decided to move from a mountainous, beautiful, tree-filled, temperate climate to the face of the sun.
That's right. This is about as close to, like, Mercury, basically, you know, right next to the sun over there. So going back then historically, so that way that others can get to know you and me as well, from how I know that Banachek had, I know you know him as Steve. It's funny, you know, as best friends, he prefers Banachek, but anyhow, Steve, for purposes of this,
we'll call
Steve Shaw.
We'll call him Steve just to irritate him.
Okay.
He'd always told me that when he was a youngster and he was bold and he would do different kinds of things. It was naivete, I guess, basically. And so he said he'd contacted the Amazing Randy and said, "Hey, I'd like to be involved with this experiment as far as like for bending spoons," because he had done this whenever he was a youth. He saw Uri Geller do this on television, and so he didn't know how to do it. He practiced it anyhow. So Randy had used him, and so he had contacted Randy. How did you come about? I mean, circuitously, I'm sure you had done magic before, or how did you kind of?
Starting when I was about 12 years old, my younger brother got a magic set, and so I started practicing with it and playing with it.
And you lived where at the time?
I was back in Iowa.
Okay.
At the time, and I took to it like a fish to water, and it wasn't very long before I started doing it. 16, I was doing pool escapes, chain handcuff thrown into swimming pools, as being hung upside down 10 stories in the air from my ankles, getting out of the straitjacket. Found Randy's book when I was about 16, The Magic of Uri Geller.
But it wasn't
the original copy.
It wasn't Randy who had inspired you to do escapes. It was Houdini, I assume.
No, it was Houdini. Okay. It was absolutely Houdini.
And why that versus magic? I mean, I always wonder why people go in one direction or another.
Well, because I was a traditional magician. So I would do magic stage shows. I did a lot. You know, we all work our way up through the Blue and Gold Banquet Circuit.
Yeah, right.
And so I started in high school doing full-size illusions. But I always was fascinated in anything that resembled Houdini. And when you start out, you know, the comparisons are always made.
Sure.
So I started looking after kind of traditional magic. It was escapes, and it was things that were obviously mental in nature, because you get into the whole spiritualist side of Houdini's career as well.
Right.
Very simply, the reason for the escapes, it's exciting, and it gets you publicity. Easiest way for me, especially in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to get front page publicity is to call a couple of the TV stations where I knew some of the reporters, or talk to a reporter at the newspaper and say, "I'm going to be thrown off of such and such bridge. I'm going to be getting out of this swimming pool. I'm going to be at this location and strung up from a crane in a straitjacket." It made good press.
Yeah.
Which then fed my business even in high school, which was to perform as a magician.
Right.
Now, it was about that point that I was reading everything that I could find on magic. And I happened to come across Randy's, the original Magic of Uri Geller.
Yeah.
Instead of prior to that, or after that, I should say, it's The Truth of Uri Geller, but this was the original Magic of Uri Geller. And I became fascinated in the whole Geller experiment. And I became enamored with spoon bending and mentalism and things along those lines. So I started practicing that as well. Got very adept at bending keys, bending spoons.
On your own, or just things that they taught you in the book? Or?
Things that they taught me in the book, things I picked up from other people. A magician that's out here that people might know, Kenton Nepper.
Oh, you knew him back then?
Kenton and I grew up in Cedar Rapids together.
But now what a coincidence is that?
Yes. And so, Kenton used to work at a place called Life of the Party, which was a little magic and novelty store. So I'd go down there, Ken and I would talk, we've performed together in the past. So I got a chance to really work with some good young talent at the time. And so I became very adept in terms of being able to replicate psychic phenomena. So in high school, he's the guy that gets out, you know, he's the magician, he's an escape artist, he can do some really cool things, in terms of mentalism. And it started, now this was my life, it kind of running parallel to what Steve was doing. Steve was in contact with Randy. I had visited him at least once or twice, had talked about, "Hey, if you ever need somebody to pull a scam on the scientist, I'd be willing to step up to that." But nothing ever materialized on that. The way Project Alpha started was the beginning of my senior year in high school. A friend of mine who knew I could do spoon bending and all of this, and was an anti-psychic, went off to college. She came back in one weekend and said, "My professor in my intro into psychology class has tested Uri Geller and says he's legitimate." And me, being a brash 17-year-old, said, "Go back, tell your professor that you know somebody that can do the same thing that Geller can do.
Replicate.
Would he like me to come out and lecture? I didn't say that I was fake. Just come out and lecture. And she goes back the next weekend. She's back and she says,
wow,
he'd love to have you come out. And, you know, here's a couple of dates.
And what did you do when you thought that, oh, boy, I've got myself into something now?
Well, no, I was pretty convinced because I had done this enough that, you know, you're brash and 17,
sure.
And you don't know that you've really stepped
in. You and Steve were in the same peas in the pod that time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So at that time, at the back of Randy's book, it said he was living in Rumson, New Jersey.
Yeah.
So I reached out to Randy, introduced myself.
Now, back then, you just send an mail. I mean,
it was a letter or it was a phone call.
Yeah,
and
okay.
It was long distance that cost you an arm and a leg.
That's right.
So reached out to Randy, explained who I was, what I was going to do, that I was going to convince these people that I was truly psychic. And then at the last part of that class, strip that all away and show them that they had actually been fooled.
Completely, yeah.
Randy said that would be perfect. Would you write up a report for the Skeptical Inquirer?
Oh, nice.
And that was the end of the conversation. So prior to me conducting this lecture, I did, as they say, in Men in Black, which is another interesting tie-in we'll explore in a minute. But I checked the tip sheets. I went to the National Enquirer and the Star and the Globe and all of the traditional tabloids to see what was going on. What were the hottest things the psychics were saying and who the hottest psychics were at the time? So that if anybody asked during this, I could seed certain people, certain information, and make it look like I really followed what was going on in the psychic world.
Right.
It was as I was going through the Star that I saw an article about Peter Phillips and the opening of the McDonald Laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wait a minute, they're actually, and the title of this article talks about looking for kids that can bend metal. So I thought to myself, okay, this is a perfect opportunity. I called Randy. He hadn't heard of this yet. I said, Randy, here's this article. I'm not going to use this lecture at the University of Northern Iowa and expose it. Instead, I'm going to try to convince them.
You're the real deal.
Get this guy to write a letter of recommendation for me.
Yeah.
And then I'll use that and apply to the Mac Lab.
Wow.
And we'll set me up as the next Uri Geller.
Yeah.
And Randy was like, that's brilliant.
Brilliant.
If you think you can do it. So I conducted the University of Northern Iowa lecture, got the letter from the professor.
And he
there.
Believed you the real deal, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Sent that on to the Mac Lab, to Peter Phillips.
Yeah.
Got invited down to the Mac Lab, spent 2 days down there, met with Phillips and several of his friends, had dinner with them. We had metal bending all over the place. They were convinced. They sent me a write-up. I sent it on to Randy, and the very next day, we decided we're going to create Project Alpha.
Okay.
And originally, it was Randy saying, I'm working with, and I've got the actual documentation. He came up with a name. We're going to call this Project Alpha. I'm going to work with Mike Edwards, and I'm not going to interfere in what he's doing.
Yeah.
And so everybody knows that we know we're working together, but Mike's going to run his thing, and I'm going to stand back, and he's going to feed me information.
Yeah.
After my first visit and getting ready for the second visit, Randy said, maybe we want to bring somebody else in. This way we can kind of have a double barrel effect.
Now, had anything started yet, or you were still...
I had already been accepted.
Yes, okay.
So I'd gone down and passed the first test. On the second test that I went down there...
That's when he said, let's bring in...
Just before the second test that I went down there, Randy said, maybe we need to bring in somebody else. This way we have two of you in there. And if one gets exposed, the other one's still in there.
Right.
And we'll see how this works.
Right.
He was obviously referencing Steve Shaw.
Yeah.
So on the next trip that I was down there, I mentioned to the Mac Lab, having heard about somebody that was about my age by the name of Steve Shaw. And in my old notes, which I still have a copy of, it said Steve Shaw in Boston. Well, he was in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So I mentioned it. And a week later, a letter shows up from Steve. And they accept him. They bring he and I out together on the next trip.
And you had never really met before.
We had never met before. We talked to each other after he was accepted on the phone.
Yeah.
We were both very wary of each other. Steve says to Randy, do I trust Mike? Randy says, I don't know Mike. I say the same thing to Randy. Do I trust Steve?
Funny.
I said, the only thing, Randy, that I'll agree to this in bringing somebody else in But since I started Project Alpha, and I am the initial instigator of this, I get to determine if he's good enough to stay in this program. Because if he's a hack or he's not good at what we're doing, we're not going to risk this opportunity just to bring a second person in.
Right.
And I met Steve, and 5 minutes into that initial impression, I thought the guy was absolutely amazing, perfect for what we wanted to do. We hit it off. He's brilliant at what he does. Very innovative, very brash, very bold. In fact, sometimes I actually had to, you know, temper his enthusiasm a little bit.
Okay.
Because he was, in this, you don't want to be over the top. You want to be a little bit subtle.
Yeah.
This is a seduction. This is not an assault on these guys. So we want to play with it a little bit more than just have everything go crazy. But we hit it off great. From then on, we conducted tests for the next 3 years before we revealed it.
So many questions there. First of all, as far as like whenever you came in for the first test, when you were going to be going in to have the you sent this letter to them, and they said, yes, we want you to come. What do? They have you come in? You have to fill out some paperwork then first? Did you have to start spinning spoons immediately or what?
Well, Phillips actually had me, had some people pick me up at the airport, come out, meet him at his office. We talked for a while. It was a very kind of cluttered office. Two things happened almost immediately, all coincidental, had nothing to do with me. One, the big office clock in his office stopped.
Stopped, okay.
And it wasn't moving. I had nothing to do with
However,
that.
However...
had nothing to do with
but
it. I took full credit for it. Absolutely. Are you kidding me? I am not going to let a miracle go by and not try to attach my name to it.
Exactly. Good man.
I was born at night, but not last night. The second was there's this huge, loud bang outside of his office. It sounded like somebody had dropped a lead pipe.
Yeah.
And immediately we open the office door, and there's nothing around. And we look up and down the hallway. There's no people. There's no noise. We don't know where it came from.
Yeah.
But I turned and looked at him and said, this stuff happens all the time. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm stressed out. So it led on to other stories that I had kind of concocted. How I first found out I was psychic. You wanted little anecdotes that would support what you're doing. And for me, it was not to prove that I had psychic power. I'd grown up with them.
There's
so
natural.
The story goes, I wanted to test the range of these abilities, and you'll actually hear Mark Schaefer talk about this in the MacLab video. I wanted to see what it could do. What was the ability? Was it just metal bending? Could I read minds? Could I move objects? Could we predict the future? Was it, remote sight? All of these elements.
So by being
able to say, I've been able to do this, and I want to see it grow, what I'm really setting myself up for is if there's a way I can fool you into this other line, that's good. But if I can't, I can say that's just not one of my abilities. People say, okay, you can bend a spoon, you can bend a fork. Can you bend
a crowbar?
Yeah, can you bend a crowbar? Can you bend, the door of a bank vault?
Okay.
And I said, well, think about this, and I made this up on the spot. Think about this as this mental power as a bullet in a gun. I don't know if I'm shooting with a .22 or I'm shooting with a .44 Magnum, but a .22 is not going to do the same damage. So my ability to bend a spoon doesn't mean that I can bend the hood of your car, or I'm not suddenly Magneto,
right?
From the X-Men.
Yeah.
So it gave us a good out to see how big this could go, and by changing it away from proving my abilities to exploring my abilities.
Completely different.
It's a completely different mindset, even for the researchers.
Right. All right, well, they're coming with our lunch over here, so we're going to take just a short break, and we will return momentarily. I hope you're enjoying this podcast as much as I am, because it was fantastic, and the bulk of what's going to be talked about is in the second part of this podcast, so stay tuned for that. I think now is a good time during this brief intermission to tell you that if you haven't seen An Honest Liar, that would be a good opportunity to go to see it by just downloading it through Amazon, or you can buy the DVD through Amazon also, or it's also available via Netflix. I think there are lots of ways that you can watch it
whether you're going to be buying it or renting it. If you intend to buy it or rent it through Amazon, please go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and down there you'll see a couple of links where you can go to Amazon, click on that, and by doing that, then through the affiliation that I have with Amazon, then I get a few pennies out of everything that gets sold there too. So that's one way that you can go about supporting the Magic Word, which I certainly appreciate. In fact, that a lot of the expenses that I have are offset by the generous donations I get from patrons such as you and others who are friends of the Magic Word. And so I appreciate each and every one of you and all the money that you have donated thus far and continue to pledge to me. They go towards the purchase of microphones and domain and servers and the like, plus even buying lunch. I bought lunch for Mike when we were out here today. So please go to patreon.com/themagicword. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/themagicword. Or if you want to just make a one-time donation, you can also do that on themagicwordpodcast.com up at the top left of the page. Well, enough for me. I think that now's a good time to get back over to the rest of our conversation with Mike Edwards here on The Magic Word.
All right. Well, we'll pick up here after lunch, which that was a good hamburger, wasn't it?
It was very good.
Nice place here. So anyhow, so where we were just leaving off over there was about, so they were testing the limits of your power, which is a different way of looking at it, of saying, I have these powers and here's what I can do, but rather, let's see if I can do this even a little bit further. So that was, on your first visit, whenever that you were talking with the Mac Lab, did they actually test you, or they just asked you about where you came from, a little bit about your background before Steve ever got involved?
There was a little bit in terms of background. When did you first discover that you had these abilities? What have you been able to do? But then it was a very casual dinner environment with several of Peter Phillips' friends, the assistant to the mayor of St. Louis, some other of his students and personal friends. And we had dinner, and then we just sat around at his dining room table. And
so it wasn't in his office then?
No,
at this point,
the very first time was a very casual environment.
Gotcha. Okay.
I know that Peter wanted to start out, Professor Phillips wanted to start out as let's try to get as much phenomenon to show itself as possible in the easiest environments, and then we'll work to try to rein it in and add more controls. Mm-hmm. So that first environment was extremely informal. Didn't really have any weight. It was more anecdotal, as Peter will even say, although he was measuring things, making sure that test items were flat when we'd start it, and then we'd measure the bend in a key or the change in a spoon. But it was all with the initial test of, let's not close down a subject right now. Let's see what they can do and then decide if we're going to work with them. And then we'll go more into the formal testing. So the first one was a very informal process.
Now, what year would this have been then, Mike?
This was November of 1979.
Okay. And it went, so that being the first official meeting, I guess, ended when?
We exposed Project Alpha in February of 1983.
Wow. So it did go quite a while.
So it was just over 3 years.
3 years, yeah. Right. Okay. So then next we got Steve. And as I recall, it seems like you're about a year older or so than Steve. Is that right?
No, let's get this right. He's older than I am.
Okay.
So.
You're the young man.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So he got his AARP card before I did.
Okay. So then he was brought in, and the two of you started. Now, were there other kids, I guess, at the time who were being considered for this experiment? Or
we heard roundabout that there were 300 people that had applied. Some of them had been tested, but the only two that they moved forward with to work with on an ongoing basis was Steve and I.
Hmm. Okay. And the other one just kind of fell out, basically.
Yeah.
Did you ever meet any of the others? Or
we met not somebody who was trying to do metal bending, but we met a guy by the name of Tom Richards and his wife. And Tom's claim to fame was he had a research group called SORAT, and I don't remember to this day what that stands for, but in essence they were looking into almost more spiritualism. The point is that Tom claimed to be a researcher. The fact was, he was the one creating all the phenomena himself.
Okay, yeah.
So it's a great way to remove yourself from the direct line of fire because things just happened around him, and those were spirits that he's helping to channel. But he was completely involved in everything that went on.
Right.
And that was spirit wrapping, table, small table levitation.
And that wasn't the direction these guys were trying to go.
They were trying to do a little bit of that. Tom actually had a...
that wrap, gentlemen?
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you.
Would you like me to split this check for you?
No, I got
no,
it.
I've got it.
Thanks.
So what they were doing is they were looking for substantiation of psychic phenomenon wherever that occurred.
Whether it was seance or...
Whether it was through a seance or through spiritualism. Tom Richards and his Sorat group had put together something called a mini lab. And it was basically an upside down aquarium. And inside of it, it looked like stop action animation that would go on. You'd see a balloon that would suddenly blow up. You'd see a dancing toy soldier inside of it, or two rings that looked like they stop animation would link together.
Yeah.
So Phillips tried to replicate that in creating a secure mini lab. He was looking at how, spirits would engage in conversations, because when Richards was around, we could be talking, and all of a sudden, out of the floor someplace, you'd hear a rap.
Okay.
And it sounded nothing more than a...
Yeah.
But the spirits are here. And then you would answer or ask them simple questions, and either one was yes, two was no, if it was yes, no question.
Yeah.
Or if it was a little more complex, you'd start counting.
Was that just the knuckle cracking of his toes or something?
Actually,
like?
It was his ankle. Yes.
Ankle, okay.
As he's leaning, because I caught him one time leaning on it. We were in a darkened room, and a little light coming from the doorway shined right up his pant leg and up the right side of his body.
Yeah.
And every time that would happen, he would lean over on that side. We never saw him do this without him standing. And he was a sizable man putting weight on this. So if it was a complex, as a gimmick, getting back to if it was a complex question, you'd listen to the raps and you'd count. So one would be A, B,
oh my goodness.
C, and once it stopped, okay, the first letter C, then we go through this.
Yeah.
So Steve, later on, as we got more and more brash, especially in this darkened seance room that I was talking about where I could see the light, every time that Tom would get to the end of a letter, Steve would add another rap or two. So the words made no sense. And the poor guy couldn't come out and say, hey, who's doing that? You're screwing up my routine. So we enjoyed it. And yes, we're...
That's when they kicked that guy out then?
Pretty much. We even had a point where he called me and said, hey, come on into this seance room that we have darkened. And he's standing in front of me. They're filming me bending metal.
Yeah.
I leave. He walks right in front of the camera. You see his back. And the next minute that he leaves, there's a piece of bent cutlery
right
on the table. Nobody questions him. Hey,
yeah.
Miraculously, it just happened when your large girth blocked the camera angle. So there wasn't a great deal of skepticism inside of there, because I even pointed that out. Well, it happened when Tom was standing right here with him in the room.
Right.
Oh, that must have been spontaneous, or a leftover effect as you walked away, Mike.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there wasn't, as I said, there wasn't a lot of accountability.
Now, whenever that you guys went in for this, did you go in like all day? Was it an 8-hour day? Did you get a couple of hours break? Did you spend the night? Was it 24/7 and they monitor you or what?
It was funny because they changed it up all the time.
Okay.
We never knew what was going to go on. First of all, we might spend a whole afternoon, go into the evening, maybe do something, and then the next morning. Then they'd meet us at the airport.
No, wait, you were in high school still, or were you starting
to go to
college?
By this time, I was going into college.
Okay, so you have to, miss school.
Oh, yeah. I was taking time off, or we'd do it around three-day weekends for this sort of event. They'd fly us in. They'd have the hotel for us. They'd meet us at the airport, or we'd grab the rental car and drive out there, and they'd say, here's your schedule. We need you 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, or... We'll do afternoon and 2 hours at night.
Okay.
The one at night, we're going to bring in beer. See if that works better. If Steve and I, having a couple beers, if that doesn't inhibit our effect.
Right. And also try and determine whether the moon had something to do with it, or even whatever.
Whatever
sunspots
it was that they could try to do to encourage powers. We filmed in a studio environment. We filmed at the Mac Lab, which was a professional office building suite. We filmed at somebody's house at one point.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to find what was the best conducive environment.
Okay.
So because of that, it allowed us to violate a lot of Randy's caveats. And if you watch the movie, An Honest Liar, shameless plug there for the movie, there's a list of 12 caveats that Randy gave to them. And I'm reading part of this in the movie, and we literally tried to get them to break every one of these caveats by demanding things. Steve had certain foods that he liked. I had certain foods that I liked. So we always made sure we're kind of rock star diva-ish. You know, make sure that we have Twinkies and Ho-Hos or whatever it happened to be. We don't want – one of the best stories I came up with was I don't work well with a lot of electronics gear around me.
Okay.
Well, if you've got a lot of banks of cameras and monitors and everything else
– right, that are checking.
I can say this environment is just – it interferes with my abilities.
Too many EMF waves coming.
Exactly. So it allowed us to manipulate the situation all the time and try to manipulate what they were
even
doing.
Even though they were trying to control it.
Exactly. So we were still trying. Well, I'll give you a perfect example. We're in a studio. They have a camera, or they have a camera set up watching a table about like this, where we have several people around here, and there's objects on the table that we're working with. So there's two cameras. There's one that's watching the overall table.
Right.
There's another that is watching specifically my hands. Mm-hmm. And I'm watching because I can see one of the monitors, which they should never let anybody do that.
Okay.
As you know, as a performer, if I'm watching what I can do, I can see the angles without knowing what's going on.
Right.
So I'm noticing that the cameraman is very good at what he does. He knows when to pan back if I start moving. If I move quickly, he's following my hands. He's not letting me get away with anything that would typically work. So I realize he's my biggest problem. So I fail with everybody that's sitting around the table.
Okay.
Nothing is working. And I look over and I go, whatever his name is, Bob. Bob, you're the last one in the room. Can you come over and let me try to work with you? Knowing that Bob's a professional and somebody lesser skilled is going to have to man that
camera.
Right. And that's exactly all I needed. Because then I could use a little bit of motion, a little bit of shielding to make the bend, and nobody ever caught it in my hand because there was that camera lens.
Right.
And nobody thought I violated the protocol because they still have the two cameras.
Yeah.
I'm just changing up the personnel inside of there. They didn't pick up on that as being a violation to take the highly skilled technician that you have and simply take him out of his position. Wow. Didn't matter what we had done. If I had waited until he went to the bathroom or something else, but I needed that guy out of that position, and they accommodated that.
And I hate to do this, backing up just a little bit, the reason that they were doing this experimentation was to try to keep up with what Russia was doing at the time, trying to prove that there were ESP abilities that people had for doing remote viewing and all this. It was during the Cold War, basically. Was there something to do with that a little bit?
This was late, starting in 79 and going into the 80s. Now, understand that the MAC Lab, the McDonnell Laboratory for Psychical Research, was funded by a grant from the McDonnell Foundation. Mm-hmm. James McDonnell, the head of McDonnell Douglas Aircraft, gave $500,000 to Washington University in St. Louis and said, I want you to establish a psychic research laboratory and see if you can document the abilities of the mind. Now, Mr. Mack, as he was called, had a long history in parapsychology and ESP. And this was almost, in some areas at Washington University, looked at as a, boy, this is one of our largest donors. We really don't want to take this on.
Yeah, but
we have to kind of appease him. And they had a tough time finding somebody that was going to run it. Peter Phillips, who'd always had an interest and a fascination with parapsychology, was willing from the physics department to head up this organization.
Interesting. Okay.
So that's where this came from. And the way it was explained to us from the Mack Lab's perspective is Mr. Mack, being, you know, the capitalist that he was, he had test pilots all the time, and there were some that died in crashes.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to be able to contact them if he could.
Wow.
And
you
find out
believe that.
What went wrong. During the flight.
Oh, I see.
So there was. Let's establish this. But there's a commercial application for it.
Yeah.
You know, if I can pierce the veil and now know this happened, that happened,
then he can improve that for the next thing. So commercially,
I can improve it. Holy. I can improve the safety. I can improve the commercial viability of the plane.
Right.
So it was a combination of Mr. Mack's interest in this, Peter Phillips's interest in this, them both colliding at the same time at the same university,
right?
And Mr. Mack having $500,000 that he wanted to fund these guys with for a 5-year study.
So as you came in then from weekend to weekend or every few days or whatever, there were months apart or weeks apart before they would have you come in?
It was usually months apart.
And that would give them time to think of other kinds of experiments, or that gave time also for Randy to send letters saying, here's how you could tighten it up.
Well, they didn't pause it just so Randy could send letters. But they did space it out because, one, Steve was working 2 or 3 jobs at that time.
Yeah.
I was going to college, so we couldn't take a lot of time off. They had other experiments that they wanted to do, like, as I mentioned, with the SORAP group. And Peter Phillips still had a workload as a professor of physics.
Yeah.
So it was time for them to digest the results of what they had seen, set up another series of tests, build out equipment if they were going to be testing us on various things, research the experiments that they wanted to do, and then deliver that, you know, bring us back in and put us through the next kind of round of testing.
Did they sometimes also retest you over the same kinds of things?
Oh, yeah. They were always wanting to see us bend spoons or bend forks or move objects across tables.
Okay.
But then it went on to, could we do remote viewing? Could we tell what was in an envelope that was sealed up? They had a random number generator that had a ring of white lights, and it would, you know, just keep going back and forth. And our objective was to try to see if we could influence it so that it would move faster in a circle, or we could control the direction outside of the random number generator. They had another application where they would take a small fuse, put it into a bracket, and increase the electricity going through that fuse until it broke. And they knew about the time what that median time was. And we were supposed to then concentrate on this fuse and either get it to break sooner or to break, you know, or last longer as the electricity was going up.
And?
Perfect story there. Quickly found out that by putting the fuse in and moving it a little bit, it didn't make great contact. So when you're holding your hand over the top of it, your thumbs being underneath, and for those people listening, almost put your hands like a folded on the table as a teepee. Well, your thumb, or at least one of them, is going to be underneath. So as you're concentrating, use your thumb, give that fuse a good little touch to the side, it would make a disconnection.
Mm-hmm.
So we would pull it out like it had been broken.
Yeah.
Throw it away, run another test, it would break, and we just kept switching out broken fuses with good fuses.
Right.
And we're throwing away perfectly good fuses, but it was disconnecting.
And they never looked at the fuses to verify.
They never verified any of that. And we were the ones literally putting the fuses in each and every time. So we were able to manipulate that. They did get smarter on the next time and put a little plastic cover over the top and run 2 fuses. One was a control. One was the subject.
Yeah.
So they did learn with that. We would fail at that test. Okay, let's move on to the next one. And they'd want to explore again. If we failed here, where else can we work to document this? So it wasn't so much about proving our abilities, it was being able to validate
the limit
and really get a proof source. They had no doubts that psychic phenomena exists. This was not somebody saying, I'm going to, you know, go find Bigfoot. They already believed Bigfoot exists. They were looking for the best way to replicate those things and show it more in a scientific standing than actually validating whether it worked or not. Because I believe they had a preconceived bias in their minds that they thought that truly that it exists. And so they're going to work on being able to vindicate that and offer the untouchable evidence.
It's amazing that an intelligent scientist would work backwards like that with a preconception of what they're trying to find, because you're usually always going to find something to validate your belief system.
It's a preconceived bias. You're right, and we took full advantage of that.
Yeah.
Because we never tried to do things that were completely 180 degrees off the spectrum. Everybody that we dealt with, we talked to them, what's your belief system, you know, as we're feeling out questions, what have you seen in the past? What blew you away the most? Where were you the most impressed? So we knew everybody in the room and where they were on what I'll call that skepticism grade.
Yeah. And how many people were in the room at the time? Six, two, three?
Oh, there could be two people. There could be Steve and I sitting at a table, one observer and somebody running a camera. So as many as two on our side, two on their side.
Yeah.
There could be four or five.
Okay.
The more people we had, the more objects that we had.
Yeah.
In flux at any time on the table, the more we could get away with.
More benefit, sure.
So we always tried to, again, change it. If they'd start out with two, well, let's bring a couple more people in.
Right.
I can't get the spoon to go. Instead of giving it back to the researcher, I'm going to set it over here on the table and, you know, give me another one. Again, I'm violating what's going on because I'm working with multiple objects. Even if they're not in my hand, they're still at a place later I can start manipulating them or lean over on them, as we did in several cases.
And most all this stuff actually happened kind of on the fly. Isn't that correct, as far as the methods that you came up with?
We never knew what tests we were going to be faced with.
So you just use your ingenuity.
When we would get there, we would show up. They'd tell us, hey, we're going to do this test. Classic case. They're going to give us sealed envelopes. They're going to put us into a darkened room. They're going to show four pictures up on this wall. One of those pictures is in this sealed envelope. You can't see through it, little small padded mailing envelope.
Okay.
So you had to concentrate. You could hold it. You had to concentrate on which one of those pictures were. They'd come back in, and you'd tell them it was this, 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 or this.
Okay.
Very simple. You got a 1 out of 4 chance of being right. So with this, what I realized very quickly is that they stapled the edges of these sealed envelopes.
Mm-hmm.
Staples aren't really very very secure
because
you can unbend them. So what we would do is we would unbend them, pull them out of the holes,
right,
look at the picture, put it back in, put the staples right back through the holes, and bend them back over. So that's how we got away and how we violated that particular test.
Mm-hmm.
Now, caveat here is, and you understand this very well, I can't be right 10 out of 10 times because
right.
it looks like a trick.
Right.
Now, I need to have a certain miss population side there. I have to score better than chance, but not perfect.
Perfect, right.
So as I like to say, if you're a magician and you score 7 out of 10 tricks, well, you really stink. But if you're a mentalist or a psychic in this case, and you score 7 out of 10 effects right, you're a big hit.
Right.
So inside of there, we had to make sure, even keeping in our heads, okay, we have to be more than 1 out of 4, but we can't be 4 out of 4.
4 out of 4, right.
Yeah, exactly right. In one of these tests, and I'll show you again how we violate the protocol, I had taken these four staples out of the envelope,
yeah,
put them into the corner of my mouth to hold onto them,
yeah,
looked at the picture, put it back in, put in the first staple, put in the second staple. Okay, now it's a darkened room, shag carpeting, and I've just coughed, and the two staples that were left have just flown onto the floor.
Yeah.
One, I don't know when this researcher's going to walk back in.
Yeah.
I don't want to be on my hands and knees looking like I've lost a contact when I'm not wearing contacts.
Right.
I'm wearing glasses.
Yeah.
I don't have a good story. So instead, I think this could be it. Because
yeah.
I may have gotten caught right here. I can't hand this envelope back to him. And he sees it's been partially open. So when he walks in, I said, okay, let me hold on to this. And I'm holding...
You're covering the two.
I'm covering the missing staples.
Yeah.
And I said, I think it's number or the picture of the red bike.
Let me rip it open and look.
And I didn't ask.
Yeah.
I just opened it up myself.
Yeah.
So you hear the...
Yeah.
You can't tell the two staples are already gone. I pull it out and I missed.
Uh-huh.
I violated the protocol. Should have been the end of the tests right there.
Yeah.
And they scrap everything because I violated the protocol. I didn't hand it back to them. They scored and then they opened it. I had to cover my mistake. But I was smart enough not to have that violation of the protocol result in a hit because that could be suspicious.
Sure.
If you say, wait a minute, he violated protocol, but did he get it right? No, he didn't get it right. Well, then it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There's, you know, no
Brilliant.
Harm, no foul.
Brilliant.
So those are just little things that we were thinking about all the time. Is
yeah, on the spot.
On the spot. How can I cover my tracks? Or how can I work to violate?
Did you guys have a chance every once in a while to talk about the things? In other words, when they gave you an experiment, and did you say, In other words, when you're coming up with those kinds of ideas, then, Mike, are they on the spot, or have you conferred with Steve and then he with you saying, you know, I think if we do this or that or something together, or do they give you that time?
We actually, and it didn't work, but we asked them to repeat a similar experiment that we tried mm-hmm. to tell them how to do. We wanted a drawing where I could look at an object that was in front of me, and Steve's sitting in a darkened room or a separate room, and I have a camera on him, and I'm trying to send a thought to him to be able to start drawing a picture.
Yeah.
And the way we were going to get around this is we actually asked Randy if he could find something on the market or build it to where I could send through yes, no, just a red light, basically, mm-hmm. a receiver that Steve was wearing under his watch.
Yeah.
That would tell him if he's making the line the right way or not. So I could keep the red light going.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and I can actually get him in a crude yes or no way to duplicate the drawing. Tried it several times because we were actually wearing battery packs and the whole thing, little pressure switches on. It didn't work between the walls. So anyway, so that was the one time that we really set something up elaborately where we came with our own equipment. We were ready to go.
Yeah.
And it couldn't get through the walls to be able to send the signal to each other.
Funny.
Otherwise, it was literally on the spot. Now, you saw in the movie, An Honest Liar, where sometimes one of us would come up with a way to do it. A classic case was a bell jar. And Steve's going to move the rotor inside of it.
Right.
And I try it. I'm not getting it. And I look across. And all of a sudden, after a little bit, Steve's got the rotor spinning.
And you're wondering, well,
I haven't been.
Yeah.
Yes. And that goes into the classic confrontation we have out at the soda machine.
Yes.
You have to watch the movie to hear how that ends. But that was where we're constantly sharing tips and tricks. And they never realized if one of us could do it, all of a sudden, very shortly, the second one of us could do it. And it might be moving a compass across the table, moving the compass needle and deflecting it.
You know, you didn't go into that, but did salt come into that equation?
With the compass?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
No. Those were magnets.
Well, I thought that Steve had told me sometime that he had a magnet. He was kind of moving something around, but I also was thinking that it had something to do perhaps with just tilting it a little bit with a piece of granular salt or something that you can kind of blow underneath the...
No.
Okay.
No, it was. Those were all magnets. In fact, Steve had one. This is back early 80s, knit ties, for those that can remember that far. Steve would actually have a magnet in the bottom of this knit tie that he was wearing.
Yeah.
So at one point on one of the afternoons, we were down underneath the arch in St. Louis where they've got this kind of river history museum.
Landing.
Some of these very... And Laclede's Landing.
Laclede's Landing.
Yeah, Laclede's Landing. And they've got these huge ship... compasses that they were using. And there's Steve, and he and I are moving the compass needle back and
you're
forth.
Leaning
significant
into it.
Swings back and forth.
Yeah.
As he and I both have opposing magnets. And people were very impressed by this.
Yeah.
But those were things, you know, we typically might come with a magnet, maybe some thread.
Yeah.
But really, we had to have something that if they went through our luggage,
they
weren't
going to
find anything.
Right.
They weren't going to understand that there's a hairnet.
Right.
Well, there's a hairnet. Why is that? Well, it's because we can unravel that hairnet and get a very, you know, nice long piece of thread.
Invisible thread, right.
Exactly. And we're going to be using that somewhere down the line. But we always try to have an excuse and an out.
Now, you were saying before I turned on the recorder about how that you had dropped some little memory nuggets along the way. Can you explain that again? You know, where you would suggest something that they would later pick up on, and then they would introduce into one of the experiments.
Well, we would talk about things like our history and how things, how we got into what we were doing. You know, my story was I was, as a six-year-old, playing up near my grandparents in South Dakota on their farm, and I received a jolt from an electric fence, and I was out for about 15 or 20 minutes. And ever since then, I started finding my psychic abilities. A watch that my grandmother gave me, never worked, was on my wrist. We'd take it to the jewelers all the time. Things like spoons began to bend around me. Electronic objects really kind of agitated me. Spontaneous things like Peter Phillips's office clock stops working, or the noise outside. And you start that as the basis of the story. Now, my grandmother did give me a watch. My grandparents did live in South Dakota, but there was no electric fence. There was no story like this. Mm-hmm. It was just, you try to keep it as normal as possible. Now, when I could claim spontaneous things happened around me, I'd already laid a path
backstory
that it happened all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Had a story where we talked about missing loved ones or spirits. And Steve actually said, you know, he had a spirit that was like a childhood friend by the name of Jeffrey that had passed away, and he thought his spirit followed him all the time. That really never resonated with the researchers, because I quickly said, well, that's very strange, because my mom lost a child, you know, stillborn when I was probably 12 or 13 years old. His name was Jeffrey, and this is all a true story.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, all the spirits and Jeffrey's name that were coming up weren't being attributed to Steve's story. Somehow they didn't remember that, but it was all being attributed to me.
Yeah.
We talked about Tom Richards,
right,
the guy that was
the seance
yeah, guy. He would do these sealed bottles with a piece of paper and a pipe cleaner and a pencil stub, and put that together, seal them up, and they were little tests to see if anybody could influence them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd call him a week or two before we're going to meet up with him, and I'll say that I saw a vision of my little brother in the seance, Jeffrey, and blah, 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 blah. And the next time one of those bottles would miraculously appear someplace, inside of it would be scrawled Jeffrey's name or a message, a yin-yang symbol for my interest in martial arts.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden that story then came back, and I was now the subject, and there was no way I was close to these bottles, because this researcher would say, he was never at my house.
Yeah.
He never saw, you know, I've sealed these bottles. You guys have seen me with these bottles. And now Mike's been able to produce these magical events inside of these sealed
right,
bottles, even though I had an unwitting accomplice
right,
helping me on something like that.
It's amazing. And then during this time as well, that when you would go back the second time, the controls had been tightened because Randy was sending letters saying, okay, here's how you need to make sure that they're not going to fool you.
Steve and I would get done with a session and either call Randy
mm-hmm,
that night, sometimes from Peter Phillips's home when we were staying there, when Phillips wasn't around, or later after we both returned back to our respective homes, and we'd inform Randy of what had happened. Then he would craft off a letter trying to be non-specific, but he would say, if you were going to do an experiment, say with items like the fuse I talked about, where things are going to be used and disposed of, make sure they're marked in an indelible way. Don't let the subjects handle them. Check them before and after. Use a control and an experimental
right,
object, those sorts of things. So when we would show up, now all the safeguards were stacked against us, and the ways that we had accomplished these things the first time around became much more difficult because they had, in some cases, listened to Randy and tightened these controls.
Yeah.
So we actually had Randy at some points working against us.
Against you, that's right, making it all the tougher. Well, one of the things, too, that Steve had told me was about what kind of a nice, not just working relationship, but personal relationship that you had developed then with the scientists along the way, such that at the end, whenever that you were debunking them, basically you kind of felt bad about that. At least he said that. How did you feel?
That was the hardest part about this whole thing. Not only did we get to know these people, they opened up their homes to us. They opened up their lives to us. I can show you many, many, many notes, and I kept all of the correspondence of people at the Mac Lab sending us messages. Hey, hope your last semester is doing well. Hope, you know, and they'd use, you know, our existing girlfriend's name here. Or hope this is coming up. Or I know you're going to be filming this thing with these people at the BBC. Be careful. Kind of a strange version, but be careful. Don't let them use one-way mirrors on you or hidden cameras on you. Not that we're worried about that, but from our perspective as researchers, we're very open
mm-hmm,
about what goes on in the environment you're in. So, in other words, kind of don't get set up into a bad situation.
Yeah, giving advice.
So they were trying to give us advice. They were actually saying, don't work with this researcher yet because some of the research has come out hasn't been as solid as what we want to create. We don't want you to be tarnished in the views mm-hmm. of other parapsychologists. We want it to try to keep you as pristine as possible through our research. And they really cared. There was Walter Uphoff, who was another researcher not associated with the Mac Lab. I was out to his house several times in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Stayed with him, met his family and his personal friends and grandkids. And while it was kind of a befuddled way of researching, and it was very anecdotal and it was very loose and not a lot of controls, these people truly believed in what they were doing, and they were honestly nice, open,
sure.
salt-of-the-earth people.
And you were conning them the whole time.
We were conning them the whole time. And I knew somewhere down the line
you're going to expose
that
yourself.
That we were going to... Well, I don't like the sound of me exposing myself.
Tell them the truth.
I know I never did that, but I did actually come out. We did come out and admit that we were false.
Yes.
But that's where, again, where we go back into, you know, does the ends justify the means? I think Steve and I and Randy were all, oh, I don't want to say drinking the same Kool-Aid, but these guys were out to perpetuate a falsehood in terms of the existence of parapsychology or psychic powers. And inside of that, they became the enemy. You know, our greater cause was more important than kind of the personal damage. And while we felt bad about it, I'll tell you the point that was the real tipping point. We took a BBC researcher and his assistant. The assistant believed in us. The researcher really didn't. We were up at a psychic conference in Madison, Wisconsin. That night, we spent a lot of time with this producer, also a reporter for the National Enquirer and several other people. And we convinced them during that night, we're in a little place called the Ovens of Brittany, we convinced them that night that we were truly psychic.
Wow.
So this producer went from, I'm an arch skeptic and I've got all of Randy's rules and I'm going to do it this 8-hour test, to, wow, you guys are really that good. I saw it right in front of my own eyes. Really,
I'm a believer.
This.
Yeah.
He put us through the test the next day. He followed Randy's rules to the T.
Yeah.
Nothing could happen. And he goes on air live just before they wrap this up. Says, you know, basically nothing happened, and they cut the film, and Masawaki Kyoto, who is the third psychic that was there, took that opportunity when Tony walked in front of him to bend a spoon.
Yeah.
And as soon as Tony walked away, Masawaki's like, no, I've got something. And Tony was like, I didn't check it at the end. There was one piece out there. I didn't see if it had deformed.
Yeah.
I had it. And this is where I talk in the movie about, you know, he had the Holy Grail right there and dropped it, and it dropped out of his grasp. And he had a meltdown. And I will tell you to this day, even though he tries to deny it, his assistant and Steve and I stood outside of that studio and we heard him wailing and moaning and thrashing the side curtains on the studio area and just having an absolute meltdown.
Yeah.
He came out, and this is one of the first times we've talked about this, and Vanacek will verify this. He came out, he had a very large spot on the crotch of his pants, and he looks at it and he says, that was like a demonic ejaculation. Now, we're 20, 21 years old during this time. We've just caused this guy, or we've witnessed a complete breakdown. Later, Tony was knocking on the door of my hotel room. We're all staying in the same hotel. Randy's the devil. Randy's in my room. I know when I leave my room, Randy's there, and he's going through our film, and he's going through this and going through that. And the guy was barking mad.
Crazy.
It was really crazy. It was very troubling to see, because we were the direct cause of that. In fact, his assistant stayed in Steve's room because she was afraid to stay in her own room because he was acting so strange. Didn't matter that she was very attractive and Steve was single. But that was just a benefit, I think, of it. But it was really, really intimidating. And right after that show in Wisconsin, Steve and I flew to London and, you know, spent some time with the assistant again. And she even said the same thing. He completely went off the deep end. And he's you know, it's not looked upon very favorably right now at the BBC. And
did he lose his job or
no,
something?
No, I don't believe he did. He went on to produce a show called Ben, Ben, Bend about this. He still does some
that,
documentary
work. That's Uri Geller, I think, isn't it?
I haven't actually seen it, but they do have a couple of cuts from that in An Honest Liar.
Hmm.
But that's one of the, that's, again, a story that at that point, Steve and I told Randy, we got to quit.
Can't do this.
Mm-hmm. Can't do this. We're really impacting.
So that was nearing the end of the 3-year period, basically?
That was in August of 82.
Okay.
We knew that we had the show coming up. And we started filming that.
And you say the show, this was going to be...
This was the reveal of Project
results
Alpha.
Of their experiment.
Yes, and it was actually a TV show called Magic or Miracle on NBC where we revealed this.
Mm-hmm.
Geller was in that, Randy was in that, and then we were kind of the final episode on the reveal.
Okay.
But that premiered in February of 83. So that was about a week after we kind of revealed Project Alpha at the press conference.
So when you got there, then these guys were, the scientists were saying, okay, we validate these experiments, these guys are the real deal.
Yes, and you know, you see Mark Schaefer in our film saying, we don't believe these guys are fooling us. They even brought to us a rumor that they had heard at one of the Parapsychological Association conferences. They came back and said, hey, we heard a rumor. I think you guys will find this interesting. We hear that you guys, in the rumor, that you guys are really working for Randy and you're here to con us.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve and I both kind of looked at each other and you feel that pit in your stomach. It's like,
if they say it, we got to do it.
We got to do this.
Yeah.
And then they said, and here's, you'll like this one even better. That rumor is that Peter and the Mac Lab and all of us are working with Randy to discredit the PA.
Yeah.
And we all had a great big laugh over that. But there was never a point where they said, are you working for Randy? Because at that point, we would have admitted it immediately.
Yeah, that's part of the terms of that.
Absolutely right.
But what kind of confounds me, I guess, is that you were a magician beforehand, an escape artist, and Vanacek was doing blindfold drives and other kinds of things. And so going into it, did they not look into your background or ask you about magic or...
Nope.
Misdirection, subterfuge, nothing. I mean, so you were just a fresh, clean slate when you walked in off the street.
Well, this was before the internet.
Well, true.
So you would have actually had to go, which you could have done very easily, gone back to Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Look at any of the publicity, talking about
any of the publicity, talk to any of the TV stations, and said, do you guys know anything about a Mike Edwards, a magician, anything like that, or a psychic?
Right.
You would have seen it. Steve actually had a very, Steve was in essence debunked. In a 1980 or 79 version of the Skeptical Inquirer.
Yeah.
By a guy named, I think the last name was Greenberg. And there's a story about it.
Mm-hmm.
Had any of these guys read the literature, in essence, of the skeptics, they could have found that story.
Right away.
Very, very easily. Walter Uphoff, who is another psychic researcher that I mentioned earlier, was driving to meet me. He was coming into Iowa City where I was going to college. He was going to meet me. We were going to have dinner. It was he and a friend of his. They can't find my dorm. So they pull over to the side and they pick up a student and said, we'll take you to wherever you're going if you can help us find Burge Dorm. Yeah, sure. What are you doing here? Well, we're here to meet a psychic friend of ours. Oh, who's that? Well, his name is Mike Edwards. Oh, the magician. Well, I was well known at the University of Iowa because I had done... Straitjacket Escapes, Hanging Over the Iowa River.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a lot of publicity around me as a magician.
But they just wanted one ear and out the other, I guess.
No, they asked me about it
at
dinner, and they said, well, we picked this guy up, and he says, Mike Edwards, oh, the magician. I said, not the magician. They call me the magic man here. How else do you describe this kind of stuff? He goes, that makes perfect
sense.
That's
nice. Very nice.
Later, when we had the psychic conference that we were all at, I see a story from the Daily Iowan about how I, you know, they say concentrate on my navel, or one of the chi centers to be able to influence metal from the Daily Iowan, the paper.
Yeah.
And it's posted on the board for everybody to see with other press reports. The very last paragraph of that report that Walter Uphoff was quoted in talks about me doing a straitjacket. You also might have seen Mike Edwards hanging from his ankles at the whatever Riverfest days, getting out in a straitjacket over the river.
Mm-hmm.
That's at the end of the article.
Had they finished the article,
they would have said that.
Yeah.
So as it's posted on the bulletin board, I walk up with a sharp pair of scissors when nobody was looking around, and I cut that paragraph
off to get it out of there because
I couldn't believe that it was there on the up there, and nobody had connected and read it through to the very end. So they had opportunities. They weren't looking for us to be. They weren't trying to bust us.
Yeah.
They wanted us to help validate what they
believed. Exactly.
Yes,
going back to that. So what was the fallout at the end after that? You had said nope. We've just been fooling you.
You had a couple of people like Dr. Berthold Schwartz who said I don't really believe it. You had people at the Mac Lab saying we're not going to make a comment until we've talked to Steve and Mike because they really didn't want to believe it. I was looking to graduate the University of Iowa and at that time go into law school. I got a letter from Walter Uphoff's attorney saying that she was going to file a notice or basically she was going to file an objection with the University of Iowa Law School on my deceit and how I was not representative of the legal field.
Hmm.
Which I thought was kind of contradictory. Because I've already said after that
that,
you know, basically, as a magician, and in essence, I guess, the last three years of my career there as a con man, I said I'm really only cut out for two things. You know, I could either be a criminal or a politician, and I don't know that they're mutually exclusive. So with that, the Mac Lab closed down shortly after that.
Lost their grant.
Peter Phillips, I've been in contact with him lately. He's still a professor at Washington University.
Is he still cordial with you? Or cool?
Cool. You know, I think he was hoping that this was all going to go away. And understand that this came out in 83. Mm-hmm. And so now it's 2015 now, but it was 2014 when An Honest Liar came up and all the press and all the reviews and all the stories. And so I'm pretty sure that he was thinking over 25, 30 years, it had all gone away.
Right.
Now it's all coming back.
Making him look bad.
So, I think it was making him look bad. Mm-hmm. The fact is that they did make it tougher on us. They did start to follow some of Randy's advice.
Right.
They did not ever formally publish a peer-reviewed paper, but we have a lot of correspondence and we have articles or presentations that they presented and then pulled all the papers back and changed the words to start putting, you know, as I like to say, you know, squishy terms in there, you know, that assumably or likely that, you know, or suggestive of.
Right.
So we have all of that. I have a letter that Peter Phillips wrote after the last time we worked with him to a Philip Singer who says, yes, I have worked with Mike. And we found him to be very professional, on and on and on. And I believe that he bent a key in my hand without ever having touched it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was after they finished working with us, but before we had revealed
the
end of Project Alpha.
Yeah.
He truly believed that I had done that, and that was a very powerful piece of evidence to him in his own belief.
Now, what was the thing you referred to a little bit earlier about Men in Black?
Well, thank you for that segue. We're taking the film around. I shouldn't say we, because it's not really my film, but Justin and Tyler, mm-hmm. the producers, were taking the film about Randy, An Honest Liar, to the different film festivals.
Okay.
And they took it out to Telluride. Mm-hmm. I took my wife and kids out. We came out from Denver. We watched the movie. I did a little QA session. I actually watched it a couple of times. Randy and Davey were there. And we had a nice weekend. We left Sunday morning. Randy left sometime, I believe, Sunday. Sunday night, a gentleman walks up to our producers and said after the last showing, I heard you guys had a great film. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to see it. They said, hey, it's been held over until Monday. So go see it tomorrow. And he says, good. I'd like to talk to you guys afterwards about it. He sees the movie, and he walks back to our guys after the film, and he says, that was a brilliant movie. Really like it. And there's one point about this specifically I'd like to talk to you guys about maybe making into a feature film. Can you come stay at my house for the next couple of days and change your travel plans, and mm-hmm. I'll help you do this? I'd like to talk about this. Oh, by the way, my name is Barry Sonnenfeld.
Oh, wow. Okay.
The director. You might have seen some of my stuff. Get Shorty.
Men in Black.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And so now it was just announced, I believe in April of this year, that Barry has signed on to direct a feature film about Project Alpha. Mm-hmm. So it will be a specific story about Steve and I, Banachek and I, and what we did for those 3 years.
That's great.
As psychic. So looping it all back in together, even when I saw the original Men in Black, and at the end they were going to the tip sheets, and I thought,
right,
that's exactly how we started this, and how I found out about Peter Phillips. I was looking up stories on psychics for another lecture I was going to do.
Well, I know years ago there have been at least one or two people who come through Houston and spent time, weeks, months, talking to Steve about Project Alpha and trying to put a script together. And so this has been something I think has been in the works for a long time with one company or individual or another. So I'm glad to
hear
something like that.
We've had talks over the years, several
with lots of different,
tried to do it, but this is the first time that we've had an A-list director sign on to do this. And An Honest Liar won 10 or 11 best documentaries at the various shows.
Phenomenal.
That it was produced to. It's got a, last time I checked, a 97% score on Rotten Tomatoes. Great reviews across the board from, name a city and name a major paper.
Yeah.
So very happy to be associated with a project like this. I think it's a very insightful look at a magician that we all grew up with.
Mm-hmm.
I just got very lucky to get to know him really, really well. It's a fantastic movie that shows, warts and all, what goes on behind the scenes.
It's available.
Sometimes we're fooled by our own deceptions that we create.
It's available on Netflix also.
It is on Netflix, and it is on iTunes right now.
Yep.
You can actually go to anhonestliar.com, and you can order the DVD with bonus features inside of it.
Yeah.
So it's That's not great. That I'm plugging this, Justin and Tyler, but I'm plugging it.
But it is a very good movie. I have to recommend it as well. I consider myself a little bit of a movie critic as well as a food critic. So I watch a lot of movies, a lot of TV, too. And so just kind of wrapping up then, Mike. So after, post Alpha Project, or I know what Banachek's path has been, and so just shortly, what have you done? I mean, continued with magic mentalism, what kind of dropped out for a while or back
I did drop out. In fact, I moved out to L.A. for a little while, realized that I didn't want to be just another waiter to get my to get my big break.
Yeah.
Moved back to Iowa, got into business. It's interesting because I use my psychology background, my performing background, to actually see through a lot of the ads that we see, marketing pieces that we see. I speak on that. I used to do lectures. Once I moved out to Colorado, I started doing lectures to CSU, and I would go to their intro to psych class and actually be introduced as a psychic. Hour and a half lecture, I'd walk through, I'd convince them that I was psychic, and the last half an hour we'd pull the rug out from underneath them, show them how they had been fooled, to try to, in essence, do a 90-minute version of Project Alpha and get them better educated. And then the interest in the movie has kind of re-sparked that interest.
Sure.
So I still perform when I'm up leading any of our sales conferences or those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in business, you're still performing all the time.
That's true.
Whether it's a sales pitch or you're leading a client in any sort of exhibition or a conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this background has given me a good fundamental foundation in terms of that performing experience. So it was a great period of my life that I really enjoyed. I'm frankly amazed that almost 30 years later now that we're seeing such a
resurgence
in Project Alpha. But I will say that it is, as you talked about, kind of the relationship that Steve and I had, we got a chance to spend, the movie premiered at the Key West Film Festival. By the way, anybody that's a film buff, go to the Key West Film Festival. It's a beautiful, magical time and a magical spot. But we spent 3 days there. It's the longest time that we've ever spent together since Project Alpha.
Uh-huh.
And it was just like we picked off where we left up, you know, 20-some, almost 30 years ago now. And it's a great friendship, and, he's a lifelong friend of mine.
Yeah, he feels, I know, the same way about you as well, you know, so.
And just for him, I do have to put in a plug. If you get a chance to go see The Supernaturalists, and you're a magic fan,
It is the most incredible entourage magic show that you guys will ever see. So please check it out if it comes to your area.
That's a good plug there, too. Well, my last question then, since my podcast is called The Magic Word, I always like to find out what it is that makes my guest tick. What is it that's important to you? It doesn't have to be a word. It could be a phrase, a mantra, your philosophy of life. What is it that makes you wake up in the morning? What's important to you?
Integrity.
Integrity, great.
Integrity. Everything I do, I hold myself accountable for. Mm-hmm. And so this is going back to whether it's Project Alpha. The reason that we did it was to show the truth against the skeptics. Against the psychics that were out there, and we wanted to really get down to that bottom line. Everything I say, I like to be able to stand behind,
right.
And I like people to even call me if they feel I'm being disingenuous or deluding myself. So that all ties back, I think, to a lot of what we saw in An Honest Liar. Because at the end of the day, as Randy said, a magician is the most honest person you're going to meet. He says he's going to fool you, and he does it. There's nothing insidious or nefarious or disingenuous about that.
Right. Can't be better said. That's great. Mikey, thank you so very much for your time and for your words and this background. I think it's fascinating. Great.
Well,
appreciate
thanks.
It. Good luck with the movie, and we'll catch up with you again later.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it.
For the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. Well, sometimes the stars just align perfectly, and this happened to be one of those cases. I'm so glad that I was able to get together with Mike and Phoenix, and his schedule and mine all aligned so we can do this lovely little chat. I certainly got a lot out of this, and I hope that you did too. I think it's kind of exciting to learn about the new movie, about the Alpha Project. I'd heard Banachek talk about this several times, where there have been projects in the past that have been started but didn't seem to actually go all the way through. I know it's difficult, certainly, to get something green-lighted, as they say, for Hollywood to actually make it into a movie. But I think if you've got a good, strong producer behind it, the way that Mike says they have now, sounds like this just might be something that will work out. Well, that was all for this week. We've got some more good stuff coming up for you in the next few weeks. In the meantime, if you haven't had a chance to go over to our Facebook page, be sure to like us on The Magic Word Podcast. Just go to facebook.com/The Magic Word Podcast. And, of course, you can always follow us on Twitter at Magic Word Pod. So, until next time, stay well, get booked, and go out and try and bend a fork. This is Scotty out.